Because Nick Battaglia and John Sievers are immediately following me, I decided I would just deal with the history and biography of Professor Sanyaya. Not exactly. However, we can go back in time to this wonderful picture, and just to set things into context, this is another vintage picture of somebody that we all know well, and this is, of course, the famous Zed, for you Americans, the Z. And this is, that was then, and this is now. And I might draw your attention to a book that's just been published that is actually turned out to be superb, which is Peebles, Page, and Partridge, Finding the Big Bang, focusing on the history from the practitioners of the time of the 60s and into the 70s. Early 70s of the discovery of the microwave background radiation and the development of much of the theory. There's an update section, which is one chapter, a very challenging chapter, that goes from that 70s period up to the present, a rather interesting time with a lot of material. Okay, I'm just going, here is the mantra of the sorts of things as we target the Sanyaya-Zeldovich effect. And can be way down on the damping tail. So we have to get rid of such nasty things as the cosmic microwave background primary anisotropies to get at that which we know is really lurking with huge amounts of information, the Sanyaya-Zeldovich effect, and the other secondary effects that are associated with the weak and somewhat stronger nonlinearity as the cosmic web develops. So one of the purposes, of course, is actually to go back to the primary and go way out on the damping tail. And that means that you have to fully know the secondary power and its statistics in order to go after NS and mNu and other cosmic parameters that are best served by going as far out as we can on the tail. But the secondaries, of course, have fundamental information that we can draw lots of, what has gotten a lot of attention. And the question is, what will the SZ effect actually deliver for us with its large SZ cluster samples? Will we be able to make a gold sample that will allow us to actually draw dark energy inferences, or will we be overly enmeshed in the complex details of the gas physics that's going on in the clusters? And of course, our hope is that that will not be the case, and that the clusters can take a stand with relatively high precision relative to the other great experimental methods that are being worked on. In the experimental territory, in terms of the high-resolution experiments, is now being heavily fleshed out by a variety of experiments. CBI was, in a sense, a trailblazer, followed almost immediately by ACBAR defining the damping tail. BIMA going way, way beyond the damping tail and give us a mark out at L of about 6,000. Quad, especially with its recent improvements in trying to go after its TT, is giving valuable information out also on the damping tail. Planck is coming. The SEA goes out with around the 4,000 territory. New paper today, Bill and company on, and I guess we'll be hearing those results, Matt. Will we? Will we? Yes. Well, unfortunately, I won't be here. Anyway, high L for APEX, first. Power spectrum results. Of course, we are now being driven with intensity by actin SPT, which goes way, way out there and really will define this territory of the secondaries to a very good extent. Eventually, these will probably have polarization in them. And then, because of the complexities of the Sanyaya-Zeldovich effect, we have no choice but to do heavy Sanyaya-Zeldovich follow-ups as well as all sorts of other experiments. And so I'll just mention in this the GBT, ALMA, of course, an interferometer if it's ultimately targeting the Sinyaya Zel'dovich, CCAT, other big dish telescopes. So I'm going to cast us back in history to 1987. And this was the first dedicated CMB conference, at least in, not in Russia anyway, bringing theorists and primary and second, theorists and experimentalists together. So we organized it at Toronto, and I had the good idea to bring in the dean of CMB, Dave Wilkinson, to help organize and bring in the experimentalists. And it was generally considered to be one of the a major meetings of the subject that really sort of launched people together to see what targets might be. A few names. I thought Jerry was going to be here, so of course I put Jerry in green. All the go, but if you just look down the list, there are a lot of names of people who have been heavily engaged in the development of CMB from that time. There were invitations that went out to our Russian colleagues, but I think that it was not a time that made it easy for travel to the West, so we missed on that. One of my favorite pictures unifies that and the WMAP launch, with a few characters here and everybody beaming enormously. And this was before the launch, and we were beaming even more so after the launch of WMAP. And so anyway, that brings a few elements together. So what was on the table in 1987? What were we chatting about? Really, essentially everything that we're chatting about now, except with more depth. So a big deal was the issue of the primary anisotropies, and my good friend George Estathia was talking about our CLs that were going from the low Ls all the way to the highest Ls and telling experimentalists go after half a degree to a degree. That's where the signal will be biggest. Jim said secondary. It's secondary, Jim Peebles. So don't take these guys overly seriously. Of course, we turned out to be. This was a target area, but of course, first discoveries that were here at the low res. But that's not really what I want to talk about. At that meeting, I decided I would talk about other work I was doing, which was to try and stimulate the experimental committee to look, or community to look for secondary fluctuations, in particular, what I called the ambient Sinyaya Zel'dovich effect. And it is only now coming to fruition after this time. And primeval dust and all of that other stuff. So here were the issues that we were addressing at the time. The model is rather, it's essentially the halo model of a current incarnation. It was called the shot noises or peak models, and the shots were had the clustering included. These were the clusters, and then of course, all of the issues that we heard about yesterday were on the table then, and we knew that things were bad, but that's what we were doing at the time. Things are still bad, but we're still doing those things at some level. Spherical collapse, and one issue is how do you actually assign masses to halos, and this was not being done well in the original incarnation of peaks. This required a big improvement with the great Steve Myers in the back here that we were working on in the 90s that gives a really good way of doing halos without having to do very large simulations. So this is the way we were looking at it. The power spectrum way of looking at secondaries came a bit later, around 89 or so. So here we just have resolution opening up for the experiments. And the two basic ingredients were there for the clusters, the different classes of clusters, in particular relatively poorish clusters relative to the big rich clusters of the time are actually dominating the effect as we think they still do now when we do the power spectra. So there were two contributions, the Poissonian self-clustering contribution and the subdominant, and it is subdominant for this case, clustering of clusters contribution. We hope that Planck will be able to get and look at the clustering of clusters contribution, But the thing that we are targeting right now with the power spectrum is the dominant Poisson self-clustering. We can contrast this with the great new result just in the past few weeks, the result of BLAST, where they actually now have, for dusty primeval galaxies, they have the clustering contribution, which is actually more dominant relative to the Poisson contribution in that case. Also on our agenda at that time, this is pre-COBE, pre-FIRAS, was the possibility that much of the structure of the universe could be associated with hydrodynamical energy injection effects. We are still struggling with the issue of the role of energy injection effects within the clusters. We certainly don't believe that the energy injection effects are modifying the large-scale structure on the largest scales. The model just fits too well without it. But those were also some forecasts that were being done at the time. And then they all essentially started to die only with FIRAS. So just to go back in time, because I think that this is not as appreciated as it might be by the audience, because people use extended Prechecker in these days, let me just remind you that peak patches relative to halos, it actually does not just masses and clustering and binding energies and all of that with high accuracy, especially at the high mass end, but it actually gives the full spatial distribution with accuracy, which is something that your basic Prechecker-isms is incapable of doing. So that's just an advertisement, because I'm doing a historic thing and Steve's in the audience. Okay, so of course, once you get that, you can make all sorts of forecasts. And this one in colorful version was from our sequence of papers where we were showing off the method. Here's thermal Sinai of Zeldovich on a 2-degree by 2-degree scale, and then the basic elements of the kinetic. ROSAT was still about to go, I think, at the time, and of course has had great success, and the primary with its damping tail has to be removed, but this is the subdominant thing. But once again, even within the peak patches picture, just in the halo picture now where you're using n-body results, you have to paint on the pressure profile, and it is generally painted on by a spherical beta profile, although we'll see today from Nick that the beta profile will in fact be a modified beta profile to better fit the statistical information that comes from large simulations. And in those days, we were using the old X-ray beta about 2/3, which of course we now know is nonsensical, even though some people still use it, it doesn't work. No, but it's in close, that's the whole point. It does. I mean, for Snyazovich, you have to go out, you have to know what the far fields are looking like. And I mean, I don't have to tell you that, you know that. But yes, I know there was a good reason for beta of about 2/3 in its day. But we can transcend that now and have transcended that. Okay, so I just thought for amusement, since we are having this CBI focus group in Toronto and we brought them all up here for this meeting, that it might be amusing to see what the figure caption was, talking about the putative, how we were going to see all of this stuff with the putative cosmic background imager being built by Caltech, an 8 small dish interferometer, it subsequently grew, to map scales from 2 minutes to 20 minutes. Well, 2 minutes was probably a bit optimistic. It's more like 4 for high res and optimal sensitivity here using HEMPS. Yes, it does. Cover frequencies 30, 40 gigahertz. Yes, it did. With a 15 gigahertz channel. No, it didn't. But what it did have is that every resource in town was thrown at the fundamental issue, which is the decontamination of the radio sources, which is a big issue, which you're going to hear more about in the course of this discussion from Jonathan and maybe from Brian as well. Okay, so the other thing that is, of course, on the table in the 90s, and still on our table very heavily, is Planck. And of course, Planck's resolution for Sinyaya-Zeldovich is not optimally designed for what we know from these days was the target, which was that you want to go sub 2 minutes of arc. and we want to actually go better than that in order to look at the substructures in order to try and make gold samples rather than just doing counting. And so what Planck is good for is counting. And what it's good for is lower redshift clusters. So it's going to get a sample, which is going to be, you know, well over 10,000, not trivial, all sky, nicely selected. You know everything about the selection function. And so follow-ups will be great, and it will provide a beautiful target for us. It's just that it is not the thing that's going to go to one of our targets with these high-res experiments like ACT and SPT, which is, what is the universe doing at redshift about 1 to 1.5? Okay, peak patches were actually heavily used in those days to do forecasts for what Planck would see. And this is a famous vintage Planck sandwich made by Boucher and Gispert, God rest them, showing all of the different elements that had to be separated in order to go after what was one of the primary things to go after, namely the primary microwave background. So this is kinetic SD, et cetera. And this problem is, of course, still on our table, and it's huge for Planck. And in spite of all of the years since this time, all of the different efforts, we still don't know what the best algorithm will be to try and do the foreground separations. And that is, of course, exacerbated by polarization. However, we don't know the date. We thought we had a date of May the 6th for the launch. When did that happen? I haven't heard it. That was this morning, because I've been looking at my email. May the 14th. Isn't that interesting? Okay. So now I have to go. I'm sorry. I'm going to go and change my hotel tickets. I got my yellow fever shot, so I have to go. Okay, so let's just say May the 14th is a good date. Planck and Herschel split about a half hour after the successful launch. The trip to L2 is really short relative to WMAP's trip to L2. You know, they have these great engines in Europe relative to the GM variety. Decontamination and cool down takes about 45 days. So along about Canada Day, for those of you who don't know, July 1st, the detectors will be at 100 millikelvin. And they'll be in the satellites will be at L2. And the checkout and performance verification will continue to about early August. Here is Planck in Kourou, which is where the launch is from in French Guiana. This is its mirror. This is its focal plane. And what you can't see here probably is that the mirror is so good, you can see Herschel in the mirror that's sitting in the same place. Anyways, amusement. And unfortunately, Planck is below Herschel. Not unfortunately. But in our hearts, Planck is on top. Given that schedule, two sky surveys will finish about August 2010. So that was the baseline mission, that the only two sky surveys were needed. There is enough cryogen for 30 months of operation. That is remarkable. That's a new development of the past just a few years, obviously the hope. That means that we expect, although it's still not baseline, that there will be four full sky maps of the sky. So that's very spectacular, improving especially things like B-mode goals, et cetera. The first thing that you will probably see out of Planck, except for the great discovery that will be announced in the first few weeks, no, just kidding, is the early release compact source catalog. This is not a perfect catalog. It goes for relatively high sigma things. The idea is that it'll deliver to the community a lot of sources so that there can be follow-ups before the official, well, not this is official, but before the sort of totally verified, perfectly calibrated everything aspect of the Planck compact source catalog. So that will be coming along about January 2011. Among that should be quite a few Sinyaya Zeldovich things to be looking at even at that stage. The schedule is a rather discouraging one for those both in and out of Planck, in the sense that the public release of the first year's data, along supposedly with the papers, is scheduled for about August 2012. And there will be supposedly a major secrecy will be going over this rather unwieldy collaboration, which is 600 members or something, so that you won't know what's going on. Whether that will be maintained is an issue, I don't know. And, you know, maybe the pressures of great results will cause something to come out earlier. We all look forward to that, not just for the primary anisotropies, but Sinyaya and Zeldovich. Continuing back at that time, there was a major assault. We organized an ITP meeting. You can't see the date here, but it was 95. And organized, among other things, not just checking primary anisotropy codes, but also hydro codes. And the hydro code people, there were a lot of people that went after it, and outgrowths of these groups have become still the major simulators of our time. So for example, I want to point to Klippen here, and the Klippen technology ultimately became the ART technology, as expressed by Nagai, Kraftsoff, and others. And so that's one of the growth areas. Obviously, we have Sen up here and the whole Jerry, Bodhi, et cetera, operation. We've been involved in various aspects of this. Wadsley went on to gasoline, which was tree SPH. And what is not here, because it was before his cosmic birth, in a sense, is the great Springle, who has done so much with producing great codes for people to use. So the conclusion of this exercise was that for an adiabatic collapse of a cluster where there's only shockwave heating, the redshift zero results were in very good agreement, especially with densities, and pretty good in all other aspects. But if you actually looked in detail at the higher redshift things as the entity was coming together, the agreement was not what you would call perfect. Here it looks at that same cluster in all sorts of weak lensing and Sinyaya Zeldovich and X-rays at two different redshifts. You know, it's the usual kind of thing. So we had in place a number of operations going on for individual clusters, and the beginnings, Gus hasn't arrived yet. Of course, Gus Everard was a pioneer of all of this in the early days. He was one of the people on the list. One of the things that we got rather amused by and interested in was the cosmic web theory and whether Sinyaya Zeldovich could be used to try and map the filaments that occur between the clusters. Here are some constrained field things describing with clusters the different bridges that occur. The answer came to be no. So here was a supercluster simulation. It's actually the biggest dynamic range of its time, but it was constrained and small. And what happens is that you might be able to pick this stuff up with weak lensing, that you actually need tomography to actually try and do it. But with Sinyaya Zeldovich, the answer is that you get into the far field of the clusters with very good ability to go down in delta T over T, and you have backgrounds like that pesky primary anisotropy to go after. But the main point is that unless the big groups and poor clusters that are dotting filament pour out their gas with a lot of energy, it's going to be very difficult to actually go after the filamentary web structure itself, even with the tomography that you would also need in order to go after this. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't try, and we hope that there will be some kind of template work on the famous Shapley supercluster that will come out of some CBI2 results that will probably be at least mentioned in the course of this conference. we have the data. Okay, so if we go back and look at the different forecasts for what the power looked like in the pre-boomerang days, here was the sort of optimal power spectrum. This didn't have any of the results, and yet the peak was sort of pointing out, but we had no idea what was going on here, and here were some peak patch type forecasts and what dust could do. Then boomerang hit in 2000. Still, of course, we didn't have any indications of a secondary. There was an analytic peak patch kind of thing and a hydrodynamic thing indicating the kind of ranges we might have expected and the different role of the redshifts. So already at this time, there was a lot of concentrated thought into the nature of what the power spectrum would look like and what we would be targeting. Then, of course, in 2002, we hit with the CBI excess, and Jonathan is going to talk a lot more about this. And I'm just going to mention and remind people what it was that we were doing at the time. We applied both analytics and hydrodynamic aspects to the power spectrum. And what was extremely pleasing for us with our TREE-SPH methods is that with the appropriate scalings of slightly different cosmologies, et cetera, which you are allowed to do, there was perfect agreement between a 256 cube SPH result between what we got for power spectrum and what Springall et al. Got. And that gave us tremendous confidence that that was a pretty good thing to operate. But there's a problem, as we will see with some of the things that Nick will be talking about, in dealing with such really tiny things as 256 cube, which I might say in our day was enormous and really something to dream about. It's a bit anemic for getting massive things. So we ran for 40 days and 40 nights a 512 cube gasoline case of a sort of standard lambda CDM, and the sort of dispersion you get in the CL power spectra at the time has a sort of more flattened result, which unfortunately we never used in the CBI or I'm afraid ACBAR analyses, but it does go with some of the trends of the time. The other thing that I would like to mention is that we had another case which was moving mesh hydro, and it suffered from one of the things that you have to be careful of in this subject from the numerical point of view, which is that it was only a 100 megaparsec box, and it suffered from just the random throw of the dice that happened to have a big cluster sitting in the field of views that you were able to construct. What that meant, it had higher power at low L. One of the things that I think under general circumstances with the use of the infamous Komatsu-Seljak results, which I think at one level, I know that Seljak was trying to calibrate off of MMH, is that there weren't sort of redshift cuts associated with issues of the experiment. CBI, for its blank field things, was trying to avoid having lots of things. You couldn't avoid the radio sources, but there wasn't big clusters. We target fields with big clusters, right? But when you're doing blank, we were not going for blank, and so that also cuts out power at the small scales as well as the dispersion. And we did take that somewhat into account for that fiducial thing. The reason I'm mentioning this is that we did look quite anemic relative to what Shuba showed yesterday, which were two power spectrum that were pretty healthy out at lower L's. And there was actually a reason for that, although, you know, it would have been better to have used the 512 cube. Right, but of course, the other issue that is very much on our agenda and was not used so much in our analyses at the time, although we did actually incorporate some for the first release of ACBAR, which is try and include a little bit of the non-Gaussianity. Now, if you're going to go to really small fields, the non-Gaussianity is fundamental to take into account. And you can just see, just by sort of, you know, doing little circles, and just seeing what kind of fluctuations you expect to get. Of course, it's Poissonian, but Poissonian, or largely Poissonian, but Poissonian in a funny sense, because you have all of the things as a function of redshift that are contributing. So although it, in principle, it's easy to take into account, in practice, you have to be careful. And what I think that Bill told me, I haven't checked out the paper, is that APEX has done a more careful job in this, although there was with our CBI paper that came out that John will be talking about, there was an attempt once again to try and deal with that scatter. So by 2004, with there was the Reed et al. Paper where we had more data thrown into the mix. We had still the excess. ACBAR had hit at that time. It was about a year earlier, and so it looked like, you know, maybe there could be a self-consistent story. ACBAR being at 150, it's expected to be down. We were still dealing with the dilemma of what power spectrum is the appropriate power spectrum to use. Now, I must say the confession here is we knew that this was a big issue on the table all of this time. We sort of had operations going, but things like WMAP sort of got in the way and other CMB experiments. And so really we should all be taken out and shot that this problem hasn't been solved. But now, as we see today, the problem is not even close to being solved yet, because feedback was an issue then, feedback is an issue now, and we don't have a prescription for the core region, and we knew that then, and we know that now. What sort of objects dominate? It depends on sigma 8 somewhat, because of going at different redshifts. Here's with density cuts. And the thing about Sinyaev-Zeldovich is that it's a source-oriented thing. Everybody knows that. And so what happens as you change the cut from rho virial down to 0.1 rho virial, you essentially saturate the power. But the point is you have to go out some distance. And, of course, in these analytic models now, one's going out beyond our vir. But that means you got to understand, you know, are you accurate beyond our vir? And that's something that we're trying to address. Nick is going to be talking about it. Mass cuts of halos, which ones are contributing. And so you don't get much of the really big, rich clusters in the power spectrum. Shuba also talked about this yesterday. What that also means is that there is a redshift thing, which is really quite amusing, of how the power spectrum is built up, and I guess everybody knows this well, but essentially you're getting significant contributions from all bands, all redshift bands. And in particular, the critical region of redshift greater than 1, where if there's any time that you expect real damage to occur with the entropy injection, it's probably up there, that we can really only determine by observation. We can, of course, do the theoretical guidance, but we need the observations. Okay, and this is just a visualization of that, but I'll move on. Just out of amusement as I pass through it, that's the thermal power spectrum, the kinetic power spectrum. And just for amusement, the weak lensing doesn't look that dramatically different. And the and then the X-rays, of course, does. Okay, CBI will be talked about in much more detail, but as we fast forward to the state in November 06, which was the first time that we actually had some results from combining two of the major campaigns of CBI, the one that was targeting polarization, that was a few years of data, and one that was the original CBI results, which is another few years of data, putting them together. The paper actually didn't appear to January 09. This is not unusual in the CBI collaboration, that first results take a long time to gestate. Other CMB experimentalists will have experienced the same phenomenon with our ability to get things out quickly. Even the great WMAP has been known to have a delay or two. Okay, anyway, so the situation there, which we'll see in more refinement, and John will talk in more detail, showed the ongoing issue of CBI excess relative to ACBAR, but something that looked like it could be in agreement when the factor of about 4 due to the frequency effect is taken into account. So this is sort of the same picture focused up and focusing on the tremendous degree of improvement that John will be talking about with our treatment of the CBI data relative to what we were at in 04. This is a template thing showing that it matters if you're trying to do extrapolations out into the very large high L region. Akbar came along with its great results. And so we had a situation where we thought, you know, this could be an agreement, but fortunately in the Akbar release of about a year ago, we weren't trying to tout this as a result because infrared sources could play a role in trying to give this little bit. And now, Bill, I don't know if you're talking about it or somebody else, but there is more evidence that infrared sources are playing a little bit of role in the little bit here. And so I think that the executive summary is that in terms of what might say as a secondary beyond infrared sources, this would be down somewhat. Right. Okay. How much down is an issue? Okay. Okay. This is a summary. Quad came in with some results, also doing a beautiful job on the damping tail. Maybe a hint of an excess there. They went away and did a much more powerful analysis. And so there was a burst of papers around January 28th and 29 on things that of this year, yeah, some with slight delays of 3 years or so, of the issues of discrepancies with BEMA still out here. And I'm not going to talk about all of the detailed numbers and the consistency that's going to be dealt with in this meeting. Just that I'd like to say that the quad results, from our perspective, don't look like they're in contradiction. So the thing that has gotten a lot of press is the SZA agreement, SZA agreement, or disagreement with CBI. And our position is that it's sort of one sigma-ish, and that will be discussed more on both sides of the story. So that's obviously of some interest. Is the effective sigma 8.8, in which case the expectation is that SZ extrapolations are down and the CBI results have something else associated with them, or is the effective sigma 8 still up for grabs, and is the template for the SZ extrapolation well determined, and so that's still highly controversial. Okay, so just going on and as a lead into what Nick's going to talk about, we decided in 2007 at CETA to embark on a major suite using the tremendous computing power that we had and was coming online of large-scale simulations. But then we decided, oh, well, let's just wait a bit until the results for AGN core feedback gave us a subgrid technology to put into the code so that the well-known problem of core overcooling would be solved. Now, how silly were we? So in retrospect, and everybody who works on this knows it, it's complex, it's episodic, and it's going to depend in detail at some level on cluster history. And my position now is that if our observables are going to be very dependent upon this, then we're in trouble to make gold samples. But the point is, it appears to be predominantly a core phenomenon, although, after all, you make clusters by merging, which means that the AGNs that are there and the small subbits before they all collapse together will do their own thing. And this is not a great story. That inhomogeneity of the entropy injection is not an easy thing for us to put into the codes. You do it by your favorite kitchen recipe. Okay, so we decided that the best thing for us to do now was to just blast forward with what we can do along the lines of what the guy Kraftsoff and company have done. And you just take what you can do now and you check to how and see how the templates are varying. And that's what Nick's going to talk about, because it's urgent. It's urgent for us to know this for ACT and SPT. So far, we have a suite of cases that we've looked at in terms of different physics. This is the what we would call the state of the art, but not using the art code, because cosmic rays, as we talked about yesterday, are in it. And so, you know, you can do the usual thing. Our goal is a whole suite of 512 cubes, but we have been focusing on the 256 cubed as the faster things to get up and running. Those will be the results today. The universality of pressure profile shapes is something that, with a fairly simple fitting formula, is something that Nick's going to talk about. That's a pretty exciting result. But you have to look in detail at how the redshift scalings are going in order to put it in and predict what the response will be in CL. And here, this curve and this curve show things of what happens when you put in either the adiabatic, which was the old standard thing that people did, and all of this feedback and star formation effects. It's got a huge effect. It's going not in the direction to make sigma 8 go down from the Sinyaya-Zeldovich, but in the opposite direction. And so this is the KS case, and so it's sort of sandwiching. But it's clear that this is, you know, a game that's very much underway, and that we all have to have, as our collective groups, a lot of attention paid on this in order to solve this story. That's my summary. Oh, my God, I have 2 minutes. Well, then maybe I'll say a few more words about this. So our frontier, you know, the sigma 8 issue is going to be resolved in probably months, because ACT and SPT will be trying to deliver their power spectrum results. Planck will be downstream, as we see. You may learn about it not too much later. But the issue is whether or not a significant gold sample can be developed for us to be able to overcome the obvious problems that have been on our agenda for a very long time with this cluster story of non-equilibrium, non-thermal, cosmic ray pressure. What we saw yesterday, and I guess it'll be pointed to again today, is that at least with one of the prescriptions that was given for the cosmic ray outpouring associated with AGNs, it's got a huge effect. Well, does it really have such a huge effect? But think about how uncertain that's going to be, right? You got to know the details of the cosmic rays that are pouring out from AGN energy injection in order to be able to actually get Sinyaya-Zeldovich profiles. But, you know, you do the sims, and you say that's truth. Yes, I'm down, right? Okay, anyway, so now I've used up that because I wanted to finish with an optimistic note. In spite of all of those issues, experiment will be our guide. And so this is a eureka moment, not just because of oxygen deprivation at 5170 meters with the ACT mirror behind. I think that should describe the now of Sinyaya and Zeldovich, as well as our future. Thanks.
Can you go a couple of slides back where you show the power spectrum? So this is something Nick is going to talk about?
Yeah, okay. That's his talk.
Okay, good.
Right. And just as a caveat, this came out on Sunday. So it's subject to fluctuations. But on the other hand, what we do strongly think is that this relative result, and one of the things that's dominating this downfall is how much stuff goes into stars in the simulation, which we've seen is also a problem and an issue with the guy part. I mean, you know, that's going to happen at some level. That has to be taken into account. But the question is, are those numbers the right numbers?
So in light of that, do you really think that the sigma 8 question is going to be solved? How good the SPT and ACT high L power spectrum
are? Let me put it this way. We will get good power spectrum, and then we will.
The
theorists will be forced to become even more serious. I hope that I've given the indication that we have are now being led to be. But it's I think it's probably the case. See, here was my position. My position was that PV is essentially the gravitational potential energy. The gravitational potential energy is dark matter dominated. So you can't really screw up too much with PV. But of course, then you add other sources of the PV, like the non-thermal, like some dynamical complexities. You throw some of your P stars, et cetera, which are the totally different galaxies, which are the totally different way of believing. So that simplicity, which I thought was one of the reasons for the robustness of our results, and we were sort of using that mantra back in 2002 and 2003, it's clearly off the table. That is to say, there are just too many other effects that can screw things up. So whether or not we can sort it so that we can say, you know, the plausibility is that it's bounded by some range is an issue. So I guess we will now forever after be quoting experimental errors and plus or minus theoretical errors from Sigma 8.
I think maybe things aren't as gloomy, and I think maybe you pointed this out as well. I mean, there are X-ray observations, of course. So you can't, even if we may never resolve AGM feedback properly, as well, if our simulations match X-ray observations, then they're good enough, probably, at least in your regions. And then that they probably give us something reasonable, right? So that's kind of...
Yeah, I mean, the great thing is that pressure is actually much more forgiving than N squared, and it's not central dominated. So I agree with that completely. So that, the other thing that is sort of the new, not new, but it is absolutely clear that high-res SZ follow-ups will become a major way for us to be operating in the subject so that you can get issues and substructure, and you can actually... not just count. You got to actually see what's going on in the clusters to see what's bad and what's good. But of course, that gives us a lot of work to do, especially if you're talking about tens of thousands of clusters to follow up on.
Well, just to comment on Anaya's comment, one issue is basically slightly slow conversion DSZ. So it's dominated by virial region, but in a plus or minus a factor of 2. So that's something that the X-rays do not give any constraint. Number 2, small clusters have a big effect on the SZ power spectrum, again, towards high redshifts, something which we have no X-ray data. So basically, you're talking about, and this is where all this non-thermal injection of energy sort of might play a major role, and we have currently not a lot of observation constraints on this. So, and theoretically, you can come up with a certain prescriptions, but they're not perfect, at least not at the current time. So this gives you quite a bit of sort of uncertainty that we have to deal with currently.
Well, it isn't just that. It could be that the greatest discovery of Acton SPT will be that there is a lot of energy injection that's going to screw up that redshift greater than one regime, and so that the power is going to look entirely different than these calculations that have been done so far.
It is great. I believe that energy injection by black holes, central black holes, is absolutely great thing for central region. But there is a very strong argument. You told that you believed before in gravitational energy. I think that you were principally very right, because only black holes can produce something significant. And look yourself, if you will not put into the black holes practically 10% of the mass, we never will produce enough energy. And to if I go to large masses, the peripheries of the clusters of galaxies, because it is obvious, velocity dispersion is 1,000 kilometers per second, velocity on the which I can get from black hole. I cannot get more than 1%, I think, into the mechanical energy, which is here absolutely important, or few percent of the mass. And then if I will take into account the ratio of baryons, which are inside black holes, these are black holes, then this ratio is not very big. There is not enough energy in it. And cooling is going very strongly. Central part is obviously everything is okay. Therefore, the risk factor is significant. There are maybe two orders or one order of magnitude if you will come, but question is what percentage of mass is in the system?
Yeah,
I am in agreement, but the issue is that clusters now were subclustered regions before, which means that there was damage that occurred by the...
At that time.
Yeah, at that time. And so it is a spotty energy injection. It isn't just the current core. And so I think that the bookkeeping of that...
No, bookkeeping is very important.
Well, I mean,
I
know
you
that.
It's impossible. It's good that here you are speaking about factor 2. If you will speak about factor 10 or 20, I really will explode.
So lie. I believe in gravity too.
Okay, move on. So that's